And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2025. And I'm now here with Taylor, who is the head physiognomist at Prosopa Insights. So Taylor, welcome. This is a first timer. So welcome to the show and please introduce yourself.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on. It's an honor. I noticed on the schedule I'm opening for Dave Green, which is huge. I'm a big fan of his, a longtime fan of yours. You get a lot of great guests on the show, and I feel kind of like, new kid on the block, like out of my league here. But anyways, my name is Taylor. I run Prosopa Insights, and my specialty is in physiognomy, which is sort of the art and science of discerning someone's mental characteristics, personality, even health stuff from their physical appearance. The main focus is usually on the face, so a lot of times people call this face reading, but body and other things are involved in it very heavily. I started the company late last year, early this year, and around the middle of this year, sometime spring and summer, I started doing YouTube videos, and those have really been taking off. I did a bit on Twitter for a while. That's kind of inactive now. So my main platform is YouTube and sometimes TikTok.
Yeah, it was on Twitter that I saw you. And I saw you several times before I got in touch with you, and you were commenting on exactly what you've just described, that somebody would have posted a photo of some politician or celebrity and you would analyze their facial features. I guess the first question is, to what extent can you judge a book by its cover? In other words, to what extent is a person's character written on their face?
I would say to a great deal. There are some things that you can't really tell too much from the face, and with scarring and plastic surgery, that complicates things. But by and large, you can tell a lot, even very specific things. And the scientific backing here is limited. I know one of the previous guests you've had on a couple of years ago was Ubersoy, and he and I had a bit of a back and forth on my YouTube and Substack talking about this. There are some scientific studies that have been done that show, you can show, an AI can detect sexual orientation from someone's face alone, or religiosity, or even political orientation. It can differentiate conservatives versus liberals. But you can get pretty specific, and there's not too much backing for the narrow specific stuff, but from a scientific perspective of the peer-reviewed studies. But I've seen it work in my own life, and I suspect it has to do with genetics and hormones, mainly the human being a sort of holistic system, right? Mind and body are interconnected. In America especially, but in the West as a whole, we tend to fall into a very strong mind-body dualism. This is where the transgender thing grows out of, in my opinion. And of course, your side of things talks about the racial differences a lot, differences between groups. Differences between individuals are also very impactful, and they can also be told from the physical appearance. And that's one of my big things, is just focusing on genetics and on the body and how the body, the mind, the genes, the hormones, they're all interconnected, and you can't change one without changing the other. You know, if you know someone who has had a lot of trauma or changed a lot in their personality, they'll physically change. You see this in soldiers before and after war. There's a famous photo of the Soviet soldier before and after World War II, and he looks totally different afterwards for obvious reasons. So obviously I'm a big believer in it, and you know, I've worked with private clients, people in my personal life, and of course I analyze celebrities. And I think once you really start digging into it and applying it in your own life, it really bears itself out.
And how did this begin? I mean, because obviously everyone will at some point think, perhaps correctly, that they read a person just by seeing them. But most of us don't. We don't trust that instinct. We don't develop that skill, and so we'll just sort of forget about it, and then we'll start to judge people in other ways. We'll wait for them to show their behavior. We'll wait for them to show their level of integrity and so on. But we won't trust the how they appear as a guide to that.
Mm-hmm.
However, one thing I'll just say before you answer is, it's amazing how often one's gut instinct about someone is correct. It might well be that that gut instinct is directed not by the person's tics or behavior, but actually by their facial features. Wouldn't surprise me. So, how did this start for you?
Yeah, that intuition is very strong. That's 2 million plus years of human evolution right there. Or, if you're a creationist, then it's, built in by God. In either frame, it works, whether you're religious or irreligious. It holds true because it's all genetics. And yeah, absolutely, that intuition is strong, and we doubt it. We have this blank slatist bias in the West, especially post-World War II. Physiognomy was one of those sciences that was pushed to the margins. It said it's non-scientific, it's a pseudoscience, it's racist, it's evil. We can't talk about that because everyone is just a blank slate. And so that's kind of what I grew up with. I could tell somewhat of the intuitive side. I could do stuff with that. I would have the occasional, grandfather or friend or something who would say, oh, I can tell from that person's eyes, they're this way. I never thought too much about it until I went to the Middle East. I actually studied Arabic in college, and I was in Jordan for a while. And while I was out with the Bedouins, they were talking about this thing called Firasa, which is the Arab Islamic school of physiognomy. It turns out every major culture and civilization has their own school of physiognomy. They call them different things and they focus on different things. They tend to agree on and converge on a lot of points, though. So I've studied the Greco-Roman school, Chinese school, Indian school, Islamic school, the modern French psychologists who practice this, and they all converge on a lot of stuff. So I got into it from the Arab side of it. Then I started looking up stuff about it on YouTube and other sources, reading lots of books on it from those different perspectives, Western, Chinese, and gathering all that up, making my own notes, my own observations. That's a great way to study it is, you've got two people with a very particular personality trait that they share who also share a very particular facial feature, real close set eyes or big eyebrows or little mouths or something. And you start to draw those intuitive correlations, let your intuition guide you. It's sort of natural to think, oh, someone with a real small mouth, they're going to be quiet. Big mouth, going to be loud. And that holds true. Chinese say that. Arabs say that. The Greeks said that. And so that's how it started for me, is sort of gathering my own observations. This was back in 2021. When I was in Jordan was actually when I started my Twitter account. And it was not supposed to be a business at all. It was just supposed to be, I'm interested in this. I'll share it. And it blew up pretty quick. Not huge, but I got a good amount of attention, and this was before Elon bought Twitter, and that sort of changed the dynamic with everything. But even before then, I was just kind of trucking along with that, and obviously it got big in distant right circles first on Twitter, and then later, once I sort of launched it as a full brand under the new Prosopa name and everything, on YouTube. And that was not entirely accidental. I used the term physiognomy instead of face reading, which is the more common one that you'll see on YouTube and elsewhere, because that was sort of the meme on the dissident right, was that physiognomy is real, the physiognomy doesn't lie, all these things. But it was always very vague and broad and intuitive, which not to say it's wrong, by the way, but it's just sort of this broad stroke analysis where something's off with the face, something's off with the personality, and it's usually directed towards one's political enemies. Let's be honest, that's the ones where you kind of pick on them and say, this politician, this minister, whoever it is, something's off about them.
Yeah, and I think people have that feeling a lot very often nowadays. I'll just put one thing up on screen that it's kind of funny, but it also rings true. Here it is. And this is obviously as a neon bright example of a contrast in physiognomy. And you can understand why the guy on the right would hate the guy on the left. I don't know if you want to say anything about that. I just want to put that up early on as glaring demonstration of this.
Oh, yeah, most certainly. And listen, Sartre was a sick man. I mean, he was the head of that whole petition by all the French philosophers, the postmodernists, to get the age of consent abolished or whatever it was. And you can see that a disordered face reflects a disordered mind. With this example, I'd like to point out the asymmetry. So facial asymmetry in all schools of physiognomy, Chinese or Western or anything else, it tends to show a discrepancy between the inner and outer self. This has to do with brain hemispheres. You have a left brain and a right brain. Left brain is more public and right brain is more private. And then they control the opposite sides of the face. So if you're faking a lot and if you have sort of a dysfunctional sort of relationship with the world, you will make asymmetrical facial expressions, and eventually over time they will embed themselves on the face. And so facial asymmetry is very attractive because, one, it correlates with low mutational load. So the more asymmetrical the face is, that could be a sign of high mutational load, more messed up genetics. But it could also be a sign that the internal state, the mental state, is a bit disrupted. There's something dysfunctional going on. And from everything I know about Junger, I haven't read too much of him, but he seemed to be a very straightforward, simple man. You know, he was what he appeared to be, and, you know, simple, classic German aristocratic values. Sartre, very odd man. You look at his philosophy, his postmodernism, very clearly had a dysfunctional relationship with the outside world, French society, all sorts of other things. And I think you can see that the proportions are out of whack. The asymmetry is there. And so that is a very good, as you said, neon bright example of that.
Yeah. 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 I mean, you can see immediately that one on the left is going to be a well-balanced, responsible, honorable member of society who is quite comfortable with his society and the people around him. The guy on the right is a malcontent who is going to seek to pervert his society. And it's obviously not 100%, but I mean, what are the odds?
It's a good rule of thumb. I mean, you were talking with the great Ed Dutton earlier today. I was tuning in for that, and he's the other guy who likes to talk about this, and he's an academic. He's great with that stuff. He comes from an evo psych perspective. So I do much more of the on the ground. These are the correlations I've seen. I don't know how it works, but I just do it. He comes to it from a more academic perspective, and I love that. It's nice and complimentary. And he comes at it from a perspective of mutational load and this spiteful mutant thesis, which I love. And it's true. Dysfunctional people, if they aren't in a good place mentally or socially, where they don't have support structures where they can get better, especially in an environment of liberalism, of modern liberal society, they have a tendency to lash out and want to make the rest of society as dysfunctional as they are. And, you know, like I like to say a lot, Americans especially, but Westerners as a whole, we like to believe in a very strong mind-body dualism. And so people like to think, oh, well, your appearance, your brain, that's not correlated at all. It's all genetics. It's all genes. It's all hormones. And stuff that affects your physical appearance is going to affect your mental state and vice versa. So it's all one system. And inevitably, you know, such strong dysfunctions or just weird things in the mental state or mental emotional irregularities, they're going to show up on the physical appearance one way or the other. I think it's inevitable.
Yeah. And what you said there about dysfunctional people wanting to make their society as dysfunctional as them, I think that's a very interesting and a key insight here, because as is often remarked, when you see the mugshots of Antifa, I mean, it's quite alarming how many of them just see, and, you know, you can find people, you know, far right activists who aren't, you know, the Aryan Übermensch. But Antifa, I mean, it's difficult to find a single one who doesn't look like it crawled out of a swamp.
Yeah. No, that's very much true. And that's a good, very strong example of that as well. People had me analyze those. People had me analyze Patriot Front mugshots as well. And that was an interesting contrast because they were kind of like, they had old phenotypes. Like they looked like they should have been sepia tone, like they've had like old pioneer looks. So you have a similar sort of like rough and tumble type. I mean, there's a certain kind of guy who's going to want to go out in the street and march around with a shield, yelling slogans. But there's still the difference, you know. There's an asymmetry between, not no pun intended, between the two sides, even among the street fighters. Like maybe there's a shared element of maybe a little lower class, maybe a little more, like I said, rough and tumble. But the communists, the anarchists, the ones who want to abolish God, abolish the family, abolish the church, they are the ones who, I like the way you put it, crawled out of a swamp.
Well, here's an example. I found this of the mugshots, and it's obviously got caricatures next to each one, which perhaps isn't so helpful. But you can see what I'm talking about. Now, obviously, there's this poor guy on the right, second from the bottom, who's had some sort of injury, and I don't like including him in this. I think that's But the rest of them, I mean, you wouldn't want them looking after your kids.
Yeah,
especially that one at the bottom right. Fucking hell.
Yeah, that's a good case for the asymmetry. The rest, yeah, just the disproportionality. And, you know, you can get really specific like I do with trying to find correlations between specific facial features and specific personality traits, which, you know, there is something with that with genetics, right? The thing with genetics is people have a really simplistic view of it. They think like, oh, you have the blue eye gene that makes you have blue eyes. But eye color, as an example, that's something very simple. It's controlled for by at least 16 different genes. And each of those genes also influence other things, because if you know about biology, a gene just codes for a protein. And one protein can do all sorts of different things in the body. And that's not even getting into hormones. You know, testosterone is a good example. If you have high testosterone, you're going to have a bunch of physical features, you know, body hair, big brow ridge, big jaw, deep set eyes. There are also a lot of mental characteristics that go along with that, more aggressive, more assertive. And so that's where these correlations emerge out of. And so it makes sense that, you know, when you do have certain ideal human facial proportions, or at least a general range of it, right, everyone deviates at least somewhat, then people who are very deviant from that, the genes are going to be different. The genes, or at least the hormonal mix, something's going to be out of whack there. And so it's very reasonable to assume, listen, if the same genes that influence the appearance influence the mind, if the appearance is messed up, then, you know, watch out for that behavior.
Mm-hmm. There's another one here, another example. And I'm sorry that they're so cartoonish.
No worries. I mean, it's the sort of stuff you find on the internet.
Yes, yes, exactly.
And that's, I'll just say real quick, before we move on, that one you put it up right there, that's another example, a good example of the sort of second layer of physiognomy, which is self-imposed physiognomy, which is that if you become so mentally messed up that you really can't physically mutate any further, then you just start mutilating yourself. You start putting on tattoos and earring gauges and just making yourself look weird. And so there are layers to this. You know, there can even be a physiognomy for how someone dresses, how, you know, posture, all this. And so you kind of have to take all that into account. And, you know, the extreme examples like this, they make it very easy. And so it's sort of the more extreme the difference, the change in everything from physical appearance to clothing, everything, you know, it's a pretty easy correlation between that and a very extreme mental state there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, again, that doesn't look like someone most people would want in their community.
Yeah.
It just screams this person is going to be trouble. yeah. So, and that's even without the clothes that they're wearing. It's just the look on their face, everything. So, are there any examples that you can give of, and presumably you don't look at someone's face and it's just a totality, an impression. Presumably there are, if I use the word rules, I'm not sure that's quite right, but features that denote X, Y, or Z. I mean, could you give some examples of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I look at mainly three areas of physical traits. You have temperament, which is loosely based on the ancient Greek system of the four temperaments, you know, melancholic, sanguine, all that. That's mostly told by body type, side profile, skin undertones. It has mostly to do with energy level. So, you know, there are some people have the body type and the metabolism to tend to be a bit more heavy set, a bit more slow and calm, gentle, accepting energy. Some people are a lot more kind of wiry and thin, a lot more nervous, melancholic, kind of sensitive, neurotic, quick thinking. And that's a very intuitive one right there, that kind of sort of difference. You see this in cartoons and media. People intuitively always already understand all this stuff. They don't really know what they're understanding. But you have the classic characters, you know, have the pair of henchmen or whatever, the skinny one and the fat one, and the skinny one is all nervous and neurotic, and the fat one is kind of dopey and slow. But then you have sort of general facial shapes and broad looks. General, I call them archetypes. And I do believe in a sort of archetypal ordered universe. I'm personally a Christian. I have friends who are pagan and stuff. And in any case, you believe in sort of an ordered structure of reality. There are these sort of eternal archetypes. Even if you have a more materialistic view, you can see these as sort of recurrent genetic themes, perhaps of ancestral lineages. But for example, you have the gods of the old pagan societies are good examples of this. You have the Jovian archetype, Jupiter, you know, kind of a broader face. I would say this is what yours would be, actually, sort of broader jaw towards a narrower forehead, mixed with some other things. You have a bit more of a melancholy there, for sure. Although that's been a part of your brand for however many of the 10 years. So that's not neat, not a difficult read right there.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a very, the brand emerged from my personality. So yeah.
And, but yeah, so, you know, jovial, or some people, you know, they have a very rectangular face. That's very Martian. You see this with, I analyzed, Nick Fuentes, and he actually saw it and reacted it on his show. And you know, he's a very interesting character. You know a bit about him. You two have had not super friendly interactions over the years, back in the day. He is a feisty Martian person who likes to pick fights. And he called that out in my video, and he was like, that's accurate. And he went into how he crashed out on Keith Woods and, you know, had this big fight and falling out with him. Just like, as I called out in my video, Trump and Elon, same face shape, that Martian warrior archetype. They're very powerful. They're charismatic. They do these big endeavors, but then in the interpersonal stuff, that the energy is too intense. There's too much testosterone or whatever it is in that, and they just they blow up on each other, and you can see that in people like him or Trump or Elon, like I said. And then with the specific facial features, that I think is the most fun, because that's when you get really narrow and specific, and those are the ones where you can name them on people and they're like, wow, very accurate. Eyebrows are fun, and it's difficult with ladies nowadays because they all adjust them a bunch. But a good example I like to use is that people with very high set eyebrows are more slow to choose. They like to take in all the information before they make a final decision. People with lower set eyebrows tend to be more quick, decisive. They just want to make a choice and move on. And so you'll see, on average, women have higher set eyebrows than men. And you can think of the example of a couple shopping where the woman is like, oh, well, let's look at all this and look at everything, compare it all. I want to make sure everything's the right decision. And the man is like, just pick something and move on. Doesn't matter. And that's how, you know, it kind of correlates to gender differences. And of course, you have men with high set eyebrows. If you know about Jonathan Pageau, he's a good example of that, where he has very unusually high set eyebrows for a man, high set, thin sort of eyebrows. And his energy is much more gentle, refined. He's very, you know, he's just talking about symbols and very contemplative, just wants to talk and think about these things. He's not a very harsh or judgmental figure, you know, very, he'll sort of consider everything. Another good one is our wide splayed ears. I kind of have that. They're not as bad as they used to be. Those tend to correlate with independence. partially because they're tied in with mutational load, partially because they also correlate with neurodiversity in general, autism, ADHD. Interestingly, I found that mixed race people have the Y splayed ears quite strongly. Clients I've had, that tends to be a common feature, possibly due to like a mutational load thing, like very disparate genetics kind of coming together. And then with a lot of this stuff, there's always kind of multiple interpretations. So you could also interpret that as them being more independent because they're kind of from two parental groups. They don't fit super strongly to either one. They kind of have to make their own path.
Here's a picture of Jonathan Peugeot just to illustrate what you were saying about him. I see the point. I don't actually know this guy, but I've not heard of him until now. But I see what you mean.
He is an Eastern Orthodox Quebecois YouTuber. And so he talks about symbolism in medieval art and the Christian he's an icon carver, actually, professionally. And so he's a great case study because he's such an extreme sort of personality, like a 21st century icon carver and the spiritualist. And you'll notice the features are very soft, almost feminine, a very long face. That's another very classic correlation, is that longer faces tend to be more intellectual, spiritual, even aristocratic. Shorter and broader faces tend to be a lot more practical, grounded, aggressive even. You think like this even applies to dogs. You think like a bulldog, for example, versus like a greyhound or something. Thanks for pulling that up. He is a great case study for that.
Yeah. It's a strange thing to be talking about because we keep in this day and age, we're always told they don't trust these things. This is just the cover. This is just the superficial level. But of course, there's also this wisdom that people get the face that they deserve. And I'll put this thing up. This is from Roald Dahl's The Twits, which I always think is hilarious. The third one along is so funny. She looks sort of outraged and shocked. I think this is part of it. But you're not so much talking about what happens with age as, well, maybe you are, but it sounds like you're more talking about what somebody's genetics and hormones predispose them to being. So it's the features that develop in the first 18 years, 20 years of life denote the personality that person's going to have by default, and then life takes its toll and then they develop these other features just by force of habit.
Yeah. I couldn't have said it better myself. I think that's a perfect summary. Nature versus nurture is that ancient debate. On your side of things over in this channel, I saw the other day you were interviewing Jared Taylor about white people and all that. Mm-hmm. He's much more on the nature side. I like his stuff, some of that. And I'm mostly on the nature side, John, but nurture does have its role. And this little bit by Roald Dahl, I always loved his illustrations. It is true. And I think the way you put it is good, where you're born with a set hand of cards. Let's say I'm an American. I'm obliged to use poker analogies. And, you inherit you observe this in daily life. You inherit both your appearance from your parents, but also a lot of your personality. I mean, anyone can see this where like, it's pretty obvious that a lot of personality is genetically inherited. You look at someone, look at their mom or dad and, see the correlation there and see how they got a bit of this from this parent, bit of that from that parent. It's inherited just like the appearances. And I would say it is mostly genetic, where there is definitely an element where like if you are a messed up person, that will show itself on your face and vice versa. You know, when I was a dysfunctional, weird little teenager, I think I might have mentioned this, but I'll out myself a little bit. Emailing you for advice back in 2017, I remember I was in a dark place and I was like, man, what am I going to do? And you, props to you, you helped me out. And you were a G back then. But it was
I didn't know.
I might have forgotten to, but back in 2017 I was like, it was the darkest time in my life, and I reached out and you were really helpful, and I really appreciate that. I'm doing great now, but because of that, you know, at that time I was an ugly little guy, and everyone's kind of weird looking when they're a teenager. I know there aren't too many great looking high schoolers out there. You know, everyone's kind of weird and pimply because we're still in development.
Yeah. And for a while, bulky and scrawny and so awkward. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was
awkward personality. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, even then, it correlates. Yeah. And, but as I developed and as I worked on myself, you sort of build these habits and grow over time, and I saw my appearance started to get better. I think some of the black pill people, not in the alt-right context of like, don't do go in politics, but in the incel context of like genetic determinism, you know, on TikTok, black pill sort of means incel style genetic determinism, where like if your jawline's not good enough, it's over. And but they call it inner light maxing, I've learned. Which is kind of what I've already believed in and taught, which is because the mind and body are correlated, it is a two-way street. If you do that work and you improve yourself personality-wise and you build those good mental habits, you get those, as Roald Dahl said, those good thoughts going, eventually it'll shine through. Your epigenetic and hormonal factors will get properly aligned, and you know, you'll start to be better, feel better about yourself, and that will have a good effect on your body and your appearance.
Yeah, I think this is just simply true. And lots of people report this, that if you start exercising and if you eat healthily, these things do have an effect on your morale. And I've got to say, the last time I did this, well, I did it when I was 18. I was swimming an awful lot then. And it was great. And it does make you feel more in control of your life. It gives you a sense of agency, and it makes you fit physically. And then I did it again about 5 years ago, and then COVID sort of put the kibosh on that, which was very annoying. But I haven't had the self-discipline to resume it. That's my own fault. But yeah, I'm just saying that I know from experience that this is true. All right, so you want to move on to, and you mentioned Jared Taylor, so I guess that's quite opposite. You wanted to talk about race and character. So I don't know how you want to approach that. Do you want to just begin?
Well, it's obviously a touchy subject. And, you know, everyone watching your stuff will know about the bell curve and all that. It's one of the more interesting questions in physiognomy, and one that there's a lot of debate around, because we see that, you know, we correlate these facial features and these personality traits, and we see that, well, people from different backgrounds, on average, they'll have different averages there. People of African descent have shorter noses on average. And so there are kind of two schools of thought with that. One says, well, it correlates. People of African descent have shorter noses on average, so then they are more action-oriented, more impulsive on average. And there's maybe a tie in there with nose length coming from being in a colder climate. You get a longer nose, and that correlates with, you know, the long winter's thesis of deferred gratification. But then there's another school of thought, which I have found more useful, which is that you judge the individual relative to the racial average. This is why I think it's important to know about race and phenotype if you are a physiognomist, because you know, and I'm sure you've experienced this. There are black people out there who are as patient or thoughtful as any white person. They absolutely exist, and but you know, they'll have a shorter nose on average, and The way I sort of work that is you judge it relative to the average. And so, you know, that, you know, on average, white person or Middle Eastern person is going to have a longer nose than a person of African descent. And I, you know, I'm not necessarily closed off to the idea of broad averages on a racial character there. But in my experience working with clients from a lot of different backgrounds, it does seem to hold true that if you judge it relative to the phenotype, yeah, lots of different phenotypes. For example, I had a client who was he had a very strong, he was an American guy, but he had a very strong, robust Anglo-Saxon phenotype. Big brow ridge, big jaw, deep set eyes, looked almost, you know, kind of Norwegian, Scandinavian. And, you know, to admit some of my own fault there, in my initial analysis, it was mostly accurate, but there were all these points where I said, oh, you're very confident and you're very driven and all this stuff. And he's like, that's not true. I'm much more sensitive. And I looked at it and I realized I was judging based on his phenotype there. And so I corrected it, adjusted it with that in mind, with the idea of, okay, you're from an ancestry where everyone's robust. You know, if you're from a place where everyone is like,
so different baseline.
Exactly. Different baseline. And that's why I see it as important to know about race and genetics. And I do think there are like particularities with different racial groups, different physiognomies for each of them. I have a mostly white, you know, American and European client base, some Chinese, cause they love the face reading stuff. But I'd like to get more into studying that more deeply, the racial stuff, because there's something I've noticed is that with some of like the African-American killers, like the guy who killed Irina Zarutska, he had this really strong, I did a TikTok video on him. He had the really droopy eyebrows like this. You'll see that in a lot of the mugshots. And I suspect that might have a genetic correlation with in African populations for schizophrenia, because I've seen that on a lot of these like paranoid killers. So there's a lot of depth to go into that with that. And that's something I'd love to spend my life exploring. And that's, to get into sort of the bigger picture of it, that's one of the problems, is that these are all stuff that, this is all stuff that we're not allowed to study. You know, there's, and this was stuff was getting studied by people like Cesare Lombroso. He was the father of criminal profiling in Italy. And he was big into physiognomy, trying to correlate it with different genetic factors. And there was a lot of advancement being made towards that. But then after World War II, the door was slammed and you weren't allowed to notice patterns. You weren't allowed to notice any sort of correlations with this stuff. We weren't allowed to study it anymore. And I'm very glad that there is, thanks to the internet, this sort of small L liberalization of that, where some guy like me, even though I'm not an academic, I'm not super qualified on those terms, I can make my observations and put them out there, and we can get this conversation going.
I was looking for a picture of DeCarlos Brown Jr. This is the killer of Irina Zarutska. And yeah, it took a while because StreamYard doesn't accept certain file formats. But immediately, yeah, his the drooping eyebrows is very much a feature.
Yeah,
I don't. I've noticed that. Screen, so, yeah,
yeah, this is a little creepy. And I noticed that for a while, and it was tough for me to figure out, because I was like, it's on all these killers, but it looks very timid. You know, there's. Obviously, with all this, you always want to follow your intuition and be like, well, why would someone who's timid, fearful, doubtful be a killer? And then you realize paranoia, he was schizophrenic. So you have these out of control people with untreated mental illnesses doing all this stuff. And, you know, you see some, it's not just on Africans, but I think it manifests more strongly in them, is my suspicion, because I've seen some really exaggerated examples of that. I did a TikTok about that, and you know, TikTok is all women. So they were all posting pictures of Ariana Grande in the replies. Cause I was like, eyebrows are dangerous. And there's something is wrong with her. Like, she's another good case study for physiognomy, where you can look at her face and her weird eyes and be like, Dan Schneider messed that girl up. Something is, you know, and not to pick on her. I do feel bad for her. She's very clearly has some mental issues going on, especially in the more recent pictures when she's been in Wicked and she's gotten all anorexic. She is. Yeah. You're looking at them now, aren't you?
Yeah. And again, I'm trying to find one that StreamYard will take. Yeah, she does not look well. She definitely doesn't look well. But I don't know what she looked like before, because I'm out of touch, you know. I'm in my 40s, so I don't know what these young songsters are, you know, who's who. So, yeah, I'm not familiar with what she looked like before. I think she's another one of these ones who started off very dark-skinned and is now very pale.
She's race-shifted a lot. She had a cape. She had a very Asian makeup look for a while when K-pop was big. But she started as a child star, and that's how you know that there's abuse involved. If you know about Dan Schneider, she was his favorite.
I haven't heard of Dan Schneider, but here's this is 2012, obviously. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how old she was then. But yeah, what would you say about her features, her facial features there?
A lot of sensitivity, obviously. So when it's kind of pointy and triangular, my mother-in-law is texting me, you've got to say allegedly. Allegedly, Dan Schneider is a creep. Allegedly. Nothing, can't sue me for libel now. But with Ariana Grande, a lot of sensitivity. So when the face is very pointy, triangular, comes down to a point on the chin there, that is a more mercurial sort of look. These people are very quick, witty, intellectual. Keith Woods, who I know you've interviewed before on here once or twice, he has a very mercurial look, very pointy, triangular face. And so he's, you know, very brainy, theoretical, intellectual. And so for her, it manifests more as I say, I think wit, humor, sensitivity. But there's also kind of a rounded heart-shaped face. That's very common among women. That's more of a Venusian sort of look. So interested in romance, relationships. But I will say with the eyebrows, you can see some droopiness there, even this far back, where they're not kind of straight and level or not kind of going up and down. They're kind of going down. You can kind of compare and contrast with the guy we saw earlier, where it's very extreme versus her. A little bit of that fear, a little bit of that timidness, sensitivity coming in. And especially, you know, looking at here, asymmetry with the eyes and eyebrows, that's a really strong indicator of mental state dysfunction and discrepancy. And you see this with a lot of, the weird liberal politicians, you know, and some conservatives, you know, a lot of just the establishment types and bureaucrats, especially a lot of the, you know, labor ones over there in Britain. You see weird asymmetrical eyes, or you see no asymmetry. Keir Starmer, he's a great example because he looks so nothing. He's just like a gray robot, which is what he is.
When he was younger, he often looked quite dynamic and cool. I mean, a bit like a sort of showroom dummy, perhaps, but still, he looked, I don't know, like something from the, like an 80s yuppie almost. But over the 2010s and more recently, he's aged into this, and you know, it could happen to any of us. So that shouldn't be too smug, but he's aged into this heavy, lifeless, gray sort of android. Who seems to have no, and this is the weird thing about him. This is not just supposition. he's said it himself that he doesn't have dreams. He didn't have any childhood fears. He doesn't have a favorite poem. He doesn't listen to music. I can't remember, but it was all the only thing that he seems to like outside of politics and succeeding is football. And that's it. That's all there is to him.
And yeah, I'm looking at pictures of him now young. It's definitely there. Definitely looks a lot better. And yeah, he's gained a lot of weight around the face. The face has gotten a lot broader. The inner face has gotten smaller. So you can kind of compare and contrast the sort of head as the whole with sort of the area of the facial features. The bigger that is on someone, the more sensitive they are. I have it really big, so I'm very sensitive, reactive, kind of scatterbrained. But him, he's got it pretty balanced when he was younger. But once he's older, it's very small. You'll notice this with a lot of politicians and political actors, especially the really hardworking ones. Everyone made fun of Charlie Kirk for this before he got killed. Little tiny face. Bill Clinton, same thing. It shows detachment, stress resistance. It's almost as if somehow your body is like building up mass around your facial features and sort of, you know, your sensory organs are getting smaller and more closed off because people with a smaller inner face, they are much better at compartmentalizing. They are much more detached and aloof, stress susceptible. And like you were kind of building up with him, he is much more cold and detached. And, you know, for a career politician, that's a great thing, which is why so many of them have it. You can also see his eyes get smaller and more deep set. The lips get thinner. There's something with being closed off for that long that I think it does make your body, your facial features, your sense organs kind of shrivel up and withdraw. Maybe it's almost atrophy. Like you tell enough lies and you distrust enough people and I mean, I know it's a Photoshop, but he's got no lips. I mean, even in the real pictures of him.
I was looking for it just through my meme folder for one of him, and that was what came up, so I put it up. But yeah, I think everyone knows what he looks like, and all of this is it rings true. So yeah, sorry, keep going. But you said he had no lips. I'll find a better one.
The real and, you know, I'm just comparing before and after, you know, before he had fuller lips. Now he's got real thin lips. And the interesting thing here is this is real uncommon, but this really fits in right with what you mentioned. And I almost wish you hadn't said it so I could have gotten this live. But if you look at a modern picture of him, his upper lip is fuller than his lower lip. Usually it's the opposite, right? You have fuller lower lip, thinner upper lip. His upper lip is still thin, but it's visible. It's quite significant relative to the lower lip, which is almost non-existent. So in physiognomy, it is claimed, and I have seen this hold true. Yeah, you can see it there. The upper lip tends to correlate with communication with the outside world, with others. Lower lip tends to correlate more with a sense of self. So you'll see a lot of artists, a lot of you know, moody, you know, art ho girls with the round kind of moon faces. They'll all have a big, full lower lip, very in touch with their own inner world. And then the great communicators, they'll have a nice, full upper lip, maybe with a nice big Cupid's bow, nice Venus lip there. But him, he's practically got no lower lip. So he has some upper lip. So he has some level of expressiveness with the outside world, but nothing in his inner world. And you can see it's gotten thinner over time, which means that I would suspect, at least, that he got so focused on work, so fixated on just winning and social climbing and grinding to the top, that he cut himself off from that own inner world and from any sort of stressors there. And he sort of made himself into this robot. I talked about a similar process with Mr. Beast. I did a video on him, and everyone says he's a sociopath, he's a psychopath. Well, my analysis of him, I saw that in his facial expressions, his left side, which is the genuine intuitive side, he was actually smiling. He was more genuine. But his right side, which is more of the calculated professional side, it was much colder. And so I suspect that with this Mr. Beast guy, he was just some kind of nerdy guy who was like, I want to be the top YouTuber. Yep. And so if you can do a little trick, if you don't have the time to Photoshop the images like I do for my videos, you close one eye and you put the thumb over one half or the other, and you'll notice his left side, so on our right, he is smiling with his eye there. It's more genuine. But his right side, the eyelid is much droopier. He's not really smiling with the eye there. It's much more cold and kind of detached. And while you're pulling up pictures and we're talking about facial asymmetry, I do want you to show probably the best example of facial asymmetry out there. It's Harrison Ford at Comic-Con smiling. Harrison, let's see. Yeah, if you look up Harrison Ford facial asymmetry, second image on Google search, or there's some collages. Because that is probably the best case study for this. Because the asymmetry stuff is very important for trying to figure out, you know, if people are keeping secrets. And this might be the best piece of evidence I might have for this whole physiognomy thing. You able to find it all right?
There we go. It's low quality, but okay, I'll find a better one while you're talking.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So while you're looking for that, so you can see kind of on the left, it's still pretty visible with this. You know, his facial expression is very asymmetrical on pretty much every level. And you can see that they split it up and it's very easy to see. And you can see here that it does correlate very strongly with what I said, that the left side, a person's left side, is the more intuitive, honest side, and the right side is what they project. That's the left brain expressing on the face, and that is what the facial expression that they consciously want to make. The FBI actually uses this for mugshots and body language analysis with people. And so you can see he's at Comic-Con. He's at a professional event. He's trying to be nice. He's consciously attempting to have a nice, pretty smile. But then his left side is giving the game away. It's telling the truth and showing that he is not happy to be there, because Harrison Ford, God love him, that man hates Star Wars. He hates nerds. And, you know, you look at a modern Star Wars Comic-Con and you can understand why he wouldn't want to be there. And so this is something anyone can use in their daily life. Yeah. Someone made a very nice composite of the both sides, and you can see it's two totally separate people, or at the very least two totally separate states of mind. And so if you're ever, you know, suspicious about somebody, or, you know, whatever it may be, you got a picture of them, check out the asymmetry, you know, try to cut off one side and the other, see what's going on there. I mentioned Nick Fuentes, and he also has a good facial asymmetry there with his eyebrows. So, you know, you make double expressions like this long enough, it embodies itself on your face. And so his right eyebrow is pretty curved. Stereotypically, and on average, women have more curved eyebrows. Curved eyebrow shows that someone's more compassionate, empathetic, makes decisions more based on the feelings of the group. His left eyebrow is much more sharply arched, and that shows that he is, you know, someone is much more competitive, aggressive, assertive. And it, you know, the right side is the public self and the left side is the private self. And this is something that's been commented on, is that he goes on these podcasts. Yeah, this is an older picture. It's even stronger now, but it was still present then. The right side eyebrow you see there. So that's when he goes on podcasts and he wears the hoodie and he's like, well, you know, I'm concerned with Israel and all this. And not to hate on the guy, you know, he's a fan of my stuff, but it's objectively true, where he has that. And it's not that he's being dishonest, but it's a difference in presentation. But then he's in private, he's with his super chatters, and he's like, you people are the dumbest morons. How are you people even alive? And he just goes off on them, because he has, you know, you can use the thumb trick, kind of cover up that left, that his right side see the left, and see there is this harsh aggression there where it's very intense versus this more cherubic sort of kind conciliatory right side there, which you see this Ben Shapiro actually has similar eyebrows, similar asymmetry. Lots of political pundits have that because it's good. You know, you have a nice, soft, calm right side public face, and then your inner self, your, you know, private self is much more harsh, business focused.
So what? Here's one, another one of Nick Fuentes, but unfortunately, it also has Piers Morgan in it as well, which gave me the idea maybe you could talk about him.
Absolutely. Well. Yeah. So I was thinking about this dichotomy just the other day, maybe even earlier today, where Piers Morgan has a very particular phenotype. It's a very specific British aristocrat phenotype. David Cameron has it. Tucker Carlson has it. It's the long, kind of oval-shaped face, the hooded eyes, the narrow nose, small mouth, thin lips. Those all stand for kind of aloof aristocratic traits, you know, very sort of foppish, detached above it all, a little arrogant maybe. But Fuentes, he does have a good face for a rabble-rouser where, you know, it's short, it's broad, like I was saying, almost bulldog-like, where he's much more aggressive and combative. And so you can see the asymmetry there with his eyebrows, but the contrast is great, and it really showed itself in their interview where you do have the archetypal aristocrat, the sort of defender of the old republic, of the old system, sort of deigning to talk to the commoner and sort of trying to scold them, put them in their place. And then he's just like, yeah, I'd say I'm racist. And, you know, the Piers can't really do anything about it because he's he's not aggressive on that level. You would need some sort of and this is, I think, a dynamic that Piers Morgan has sort of played around with a lot, and it's actually made a lot of right-wing careers. If you'll recall, Ben Shapiro got his start in, I think, 2012, being on Piers Morgan on his Guns in America segment. And this was a real famous one where he really, you know, tore up Piers Morgan and, you know, got him with his whole fast-talking shit. And that was a similar sort of thing. Ben Shapiro and Nick Fuentes, you know, Nick probably wouldn't want to hear this, but neither would Ben. They do have similar looks, similar short kind of square face, short nose, big eyebrows, a lot of bulldog aggression there. A lot of your best fast-talking pundits, they have this sort of thing going. And so there is this, seems to be this dichotomy in the world of punditry between the more aristocratic, like I said, foppish sort of types and the more aggressive bulldogs.
Yeah, the only one I looked through my meme folder and yeah, here's one of Ben Shapiro.
Yeah. That's pretty good. It's been a while since I've seen any Next Generation. I need to watch that again. It's good. That's, I will say, maybe slightly off topic, I would just like to publicly announce, I've loved your Doctor Who articles about Russell T. Davies and all that.
Great stuff. Well, thank you. That was a year and a half ago. It was the middle of last year, but I've written a new chapter because of this season two, and I want to wait until the demise of this era, and then I'll write another chapter to end it, and those two will be published together. Thank you. I'm glad that went down much better than I was expecting. But, you know, that's a whole other thing. I'll bring up Russell T. Davis, and you can maybe.
I'd love to do that.
The producer of showrunner of Doctor Who.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, when it was the like David Tennant era. I loved Doctor Who, but I remember watching it as this little boy from, you know, Bush era Alabama, and thinking, man, Britain is so liberal, because it's like every other character was like gay or lesbian or transgender or whatever, and I was like, what is going on over there? And you know, Britain is more advanced in liberalism than America, but I didn't realize at the time that Russell T. Davis was gay, and so that bias was sort of distorting.
Yeah. even then, and that's the mid to late 2000s. So this is the guy, and he is very gay. Yeah.
Yeah, there's yeah, you can see the asymmetry there really strongly in the eyes. There is a so the right side is much more peppy, much more alive, especially with the eye. It's much more open, much more cheery. You know, he does have a bit of a Jovian thing going, very broadler face. So he presents himself as being very jolly, jovial, you know, fun guy. But the left eye, if you see, very contemptuous. There's a lot of smug arrogance there on his left side, especially in the eye, where he is looking down on the masses. And you will also notice small interface there, just like Charlie Kirk, just like Keir Starmer, where there is...
It's amazing. Every photo I find, I'm looking at all these photos of him, and what you're saying rings true for every one of them.
Mm.
Here is another one. There we go.
Let's see. Yeah, yeah. The asymmetry there in the eyes, the contemptuous inner self. And you'll notice with him, very thin upper lip. So I think he does a lot of public speaking. I would suspect he plays it close to the chest, that he doesn't... He's pretty hesitant when expressing what he really thinks and feels. When you see people with a really thin upper lip, it's generally going to stand for that, for someone. Even if they talk a lot, they're not going to be
playing a role. Really
they can feel. Yes. Yeah. Playing a role.
Yeah.
The last thing with him, I'd say, you can go ahead.
Go on. Well, I think he does play a role because I think that his behavior with, because he comes across as very jovial and gregarious and happy and all this, but his behavior only makes sense if he has a lot of inner turmoil and self-doubt and intense and bouts of depression. Therefore, I think he's hiding all of that all the time when he's in public.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Last thing I'll say on him, just a quick little one, with the ears. First off, they're very close, flat to the head. So there's not a lot of independence. He's very dependent on his relationships, very conformist. He wants to be nested within a community very strongly. I know he's big into the gay community and a big activist for that. You'll also see the middle thirds of the ear there. They bulge out. And so that stands for an interest primarily in social and emotional pursuits. So when you see that mid-third of the ear come out, he's most interested in that. So social activism would be a very socially dependent person. Like he would have, despite his sort of stress resistance with the face there, I would suspect that he would have trouble finding sort of fulfillment outside of some big, you know, emotional and social community.
Mm-hmm. Well, that rings true, but based on what he said about himself. Here's one more. There was another one, actually better than that. Hold on a minute. There's another photo of him, which I thought, when I saw it, I was kind of shocked that I don't know, maybe other people won't have the same reaction, but I thought, why would a grown man let himself be photographed like this? Hold on, because he looks like a big baby. Hold on.
Take your time. I want to see it.
All right, here it is.
Oh my. Well, the fashion, you know, I've got a friend who's big in men's fashion. He could tear this apart. Oh my gosh. yeah, it's just very odd. And he, yeah, you're very much right. The lighting is terrible, too. You know, you and I both know, you know, lighting is very important for how your video, are you going to look on video or on camera, very flat and washed out. But he does just look like a big goofy baby. And, that's a thing that happens with a lot of gay guys, because if you're into the homosexual lifestyle, there is this weird sort of Peter Pan, Neverland boy syndrome where, you do kind of are kind of pushed into being a man-child. There's sort of a dichotomy with it where there's some sort of stuntedness with it because you never marry the wife and have the kids. And not to say that all men have to do that or they're dysfunctional, but it's a normal rite of passage. And so if you consciously reject that and say, I'm going to live this totally separate lifestyle, even if you're, you know, marrying quote unquote a man, and then they do the surrogacy thing like Dave Rubin, which is disgusting, horrible stuff. But even with that, I mean, there's still a level of immaturity, childishness. You never, you know, have the, you're never sort of forced into the responsible role of having to, you know, protect and take care of and watch after a wife and kids and stuff. And,
so, and not be selfish.
Not be selfish, exactly. So some of them, they take a much more adolescent teenage route where they become hedonists. You know, these are the ones where, if you remember Common Filth from back in the day, he would cover all that. I think he passed away recently, actually, God rest his soul. But
really? I didn't know.
It might have been a rumor, but I he's been inactive for a while, but I saw something from – it seemed legit, but I hadn't seen his stuff in a while, but I think he might have passed. That's what I heard, at least. If he has, God bless him. But you remember him from back in the day, and he would cover all – you know, what a gay party is actually like. And it's just worse than you could ever imagine. So there's that side of it where it's just the rank hedonism. You know, there's some statistic, a gay man has an average of like 100 sexual partners in a lifetime, some up in the thousands. But then there's another side where, and this is maybe more of the modern gay, the softer post-AIDS version, where you do just become kind of a man baby. I think of YouTuber JJ McCullough. And I actually like him. You know, he does neat, fun little videos. But he is very, very liberal, and he's a gay Canadian YouTuber, and he's one of these guys where his background is all little Nintendo toys and Earthbound stuff. And I think he's right around your age, actually.
There are too many such cases. And maybe it's because I'm aware of it in myself, but I see it more pronounced in these guys where they've got, you know, the little Dalek toys and the He-Man figurines and all the posters and these things that the weird head things that are fashionable nowadays. I mean, for God's sake, you know, I don't know. You can enjoy these films and TV shows, but I think it's, there's something really bad. It just seems so unhealthy to make it your lifestyle in that way, because that's what a child does. It's not a
grown man. It's disordered. It's childishness. A child plays with toys and has imagination in preparation for being an adult. And it's supposed to be that once you're an adult, you put that away. There's a great image I saw years ago. It was a news story about there was a mutant tadpole that they pulled out of a river in Arizona, I think, a bullfrog tadpole. And everyone knows how the life cycle works. You learn it in the grade school. But the thing is, it was a mutant. So it never had the trigger for metamorphosis. So it just kept getting bigger and bigger until you had a tadpole the size of a full-grown frog or even bigger. And that's what a lot of men, especially a lot of modern guys, are like that, where they are this big, fat tadpole that never has to become selfless, right? Never has to sacrifice for your wife, your children, your church, your community. It just becomes this Peter Pan syndrome where I'm just going to collect toys forever, and that's the purpose of my existence, is to collect plastic crap. And
yeah, sad. Yeah. And pretend to care about it in the way that I did when I was a child, but I can't because I'm not a child, so it's all a lie. And this is what I wrote at the end of that essay series that you talked about, The Seeds of Gay Doom. Everyone should go and read that, by the way. Even if you're not a fan of Doctor Who, you're not a fan of sci-fi, lots of people aren't, and they've told me that they enjoyed reading it. And at the end of that, I made this point that for a lot of people now, science fiction and that whole thing, fantasy, the cosplay, the Comic Con, it's just a way to avoid growing up and to kid yourself about it. Mm-hmm. Well, literally, to delude yourself. And I find it extremely unhealthy, and morbid. I don't know what to say, but there is a link with the gay thing for sure. And again, I made that specific point in it, but it's not. But that it goes much wider than that. I think.
Yeah.
This is what I said, that gay men were the sort of prototype for this lifestyle because they, you know, back in the 90s, or whatever, because they didn't have to have a family and whatever. But now it's been exported to straight people, or well, people who would once have been straight, and they're now non-binary or whatever. But it's been exported to a much wider range of people, and they're taking refuge in the entertainment products of their childhood. So, yeah, I think it's a very interesting and dark aspect of the, of modern culture. Okay, yeah. So to move on from that, you wanted to talk about the burgeoning dissident renaissance in academia and science as a whole. So that's
yeah,
bit of a topic change, but let's go for it.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. And this is it's pretty broad, but I'd say it encompasses kind of both of our worlds here, where I've always been interested in fringe science, in the unknown, the supernatural. You know, to use 4chan terms, right? I've gotten into the pole sort of stuff a lot, but my first love was X. I loved the X-Files as a kid. I would go to the library and get anything on UFOs, Bigfoot, anything. In fact, when I was 10 years old, I accidentally checked out a Peter Brimelow book, his book Alien Nation, because I thought it was about aliens. And I have this distinct memory of being a kid and going to be like, awesome, and turning to a middle page. And it was the part, like the chapter where he talks about how Jewish advocacy groups are pushing for mass immigration. This was back in the 90s. And I was a 10-year-old kid, and I was like, this isn't about aliens. Turn this crap. I remember that years later, I was like, oh my gosh, like I was, that was before anyone, you know, was talking about that even online. But I was big into that, and it does all sort of tie together because with physiognomy specifically, and a number of other things, you know, with Jared Taylor and Peter Brimelow, the race and IQ stuff, and not even, it's not even real racial hatred. It's not like Peter, you know, Jared Taylor is the leader of Blood Tribe, you know, marching around with swastikas in Florida or anything. I mean, you know, or Charles Murray or James Watson, that I, you know, that's what Ed Dutton was talking about with you earlier today. It was James Watson, right? The DNA guy. Where, you know, even all these different things because it is inconvenient towards the blank slatist dogma of the liberal post-World War II New Deal regime, it is forbidden to discuss or even to investigate, nonetheless to believe in. And so for a long time, with politics as in science, there is this broad matrix of control where, you know, if you try to question anything, try to step outside of this control system, this paradigm, the media comes down to you from the bully pulpit and says, applies a label, conspiracy theorist, racist, Nazi, dangerous, terrorist, hater, whatever. But as that is loosening up, thanks to the internet and thanks to broader societal changes, not to sound too much like a Marxist, but the internal contradictions are making it collapse in on itself. I think it's inevitable at this point. Everyone's waking up. You go on Instagram. Instagram is more hardcore than poll was in 2015. If you look at it now, it's like normies posting on their main accounts under Nick Fuentes or Alex Jones clips being like 100% true. And it's a crazy paradigm shift that I don't think any of us ever thought we would see. And so with that, there is this small L liberalization, much like with Twitter getting opened up by Elon Musk, where it's a new paradigm. And that applies to politics, of course, where we can start being nationalists. We can start saying, you know, maybe Europe shouldn't let in 25 billion Muslims a year or whatever. Maybe we shouldn't become a caliphate. But we can also say, you know, does science have everything figured out? And it really got dealt its mortal blow, I think, by COVID. because that's when the mask is pulled off in this whole politicized science regime, where it's like, nope, the science is settled. You have to trust the science. In science and research, as in politics, I think COVID was kind of the Chernobyl moment where everyone was just like, okay, this is not working. Like, I don't trust this anymore. And much as with the political situation, you do get a lot of kookery that comes from that re-enchantment of the world, right? I love that article by your buddy Morgoth about Jimmy Savile, where going into, you know, Jimmy Savile, like born on Halloween, he was probably like a literal wizard doing like magic on people and all sorts of terrible things.
Just to say, Morgoth has written an essay about this. If you search the Substack, you'll find it. It was about a year ago, year and a quarter ago, I think.
Yeah. The re-enchantment of the world, where he was sort of pointing out the dangerous side of that. But that is something that's happened, is like, you know, the proles will do their own thing. But among young intellectual elites, it's not like it was 100 years ago. 100 years ago in the 20th century, the paradigm was atheism. It was the H.G. Wells. One world, there's going to be one world government, there's going to be socialism. You know, if you remember classic Star Trek, that generation of Walt Disney and Gene Roddenberry was saying it's going to be a perfect, like, materialist, one world government, atheist utopia. And over the past 50 or so years, that's been falling apart, especially in the past 5 years. And so, like I said, you get lots of kookery. You get the Candace Owens people of the world talking about all these wacky conspiracies and you know, fairies and demons and all that. Not to say that stuff doesn't have anything to it, but it's almost like we were stuck in the nursery. People use this analogy a lot, that liberalism is like this Benthamite massive nursing home, and we were in the nursing home or in the nursery. Now we've been thrown into the jungle, and so it's there are dangers, but it's of a different sort. Where before, you know, we're kind of emerging from this stifling order into this dynamic chaos. And I think that's going to play out physically and literally in the political scale, especially in Europe, with all the demographic problems you guys have there, and probably in America. The peaceful solution, the people who are in positions to make peaceful reforms that can prevent something bad, have not been doing them and show no sign of doing them. We've seen this with Trump. So it looks like, you know, in a broad Hegelian historical dialectic sense, we are kind of headed towards some sort of clash, confrontation. But simultaneously, that's happening on an intellectual level, where the ideas are all in flux, and the old paradigms are shattered, and new paradigms have to emerge. That's why I love and respect this show, because it's like the little seedling of, like, when a star starts to develop in a nebula, it's the guy who has the vision to say, we have all these individual people, let's bring them all together and start to make something. And you see it a lot in politics. Not to glaze the host too much, but I do admire the project, and I have for a while.
Thank you. Thank you.
But you see that. And I discussed this actually at length with people who are very much not political. Doctors Anastasia and Shiloh of the Demystify Sci podcast, and their stuff, they mostly interview professors and PhDs and stuff, and their stuff is about fringe physics. So they'll talk about new theories of astrophysics. Maybe the aether is real. Maybe the dual nature of light was a mistake. People talking about morphic resonance and the stuff about cell structures, all these things that are just these new discoveries that are just demolishing the old paradigm of science we had. You know, you learning in grade school, everything is just, it's all atoms and molecules and energy, and we've all got it figured out and nothing more to it. There's actually a lot more to it. And so that's sort of my big picture worldview, like, to sort of give away the game, show the secret sauce a little bit. That is my view of the world as it is right now in 2025. And that's how I see myself in it, is like one voice among many who's trying to make sense of the madness. Where, you know, and maybe in times past, I would have thought of myself as more of a provocateur, where it's like there's a stifling, oppressive system where, like, we've got to wake people up, we got to break them out of it. People are woken up now. Like, everyone's mom is into Candace Owens. Like, it, you know, 10 years ago, the young Chud would be going to his parents being like, "Mom, there's a conspiracy with Israel." And they'd be like, "That's racist," or like, "You're crazy." Now it's the other way around. Now the parents are coming to the kids and be like, "Candace Owens told me about the conspiracy with Israel." I'm like, come on, you're getting crazy. And this is
It's exciting, isn't it? I mean, you get this sense that things are just rapidly changing. And absolutely, stuff that you used to be an outsider for having these ideas or being interested in these things, and now the normies are doing it. I mean, it's kind of dizzying.
It is dizzying. I like your optimism with it, because I feel that, you know, some people are scared of it, rightfully so. I think it's sort of like bungee jumping, right? You got it, which I've never done, but you know, you get the idea where it's a little frightening. You think, well, what if the worst comes to worst comes to worst? But at the other, on the other hand, you're like, hey, you know, this could be great. And you know, it is change, and change is always has the potential. Any sort of great thing always has the potential for immense risk and danger. And that's what being that's what living life is all about, I think, is confronting that and taking it by the horns. And that's sort of how I, you know, why it is that I, who am, you know, I'm sort of this fringe science person, you know, I see it as this burgeoning milieu where it's no longer about like, well, there's the right wing or even the alt-right or anything, where it's just like, it's dissidents where I can talk to and be buddies with and do interviews with, you know, the dissident politics guy, but also with, you know, the professors who talk about new theories of physics, and with, I mean, I'm not going to beat the allegations of being, you know, of physiognomy being like another astrology, but I do talk to a lot of astrologers, you know, people who are into the more occult esoteric side, neo-pagans and you know, on the Christian side, priests and stuff. Cause I see it as all, I want to talk to everyone, you know, cause it's one big milieu. I mean, that's certainly what you're about on here.
Yeah.
Bring them all together and hear them out.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it's always been about. And actually millennial 2017 was very varied. I think I've never been quite that varied since, but I do like to have people on to talk about different things. For example, I didn't even know whether, I didn't know about your politics, for example. So I didn't bring you on because I thought you're one of us or something. It was specifically for the physiognomy stuff, because I thought that's interesting and people will, I know that my audience will probably be interested in that. So yeah, I think it is important. And we are breaking a paradigm here. That's what we're aspiring to do. And so, you know, I don't think that anything goes. I don't think I'm not going to have crazy stuff, like stuff that strikes me as crazy. But I do want to have a wide range of people on, for sure.
Yeah.
It's a new synthesis of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a lot about that, the new synthesis of like where we go from here. And it's heartening. It's encouraging to see that there are people on all sides of things, right? Whether it's, you know, talking about, I mentioned Jonathan Pezure, that's kind of his big thing, is bringing back these sort of ancient or even eternal things to the public eye and making them accessible in like a podcast or a YouTube video, where he's talking about these ancient, you know, religious symbols and mythological stuff. And that's the stuff that Jordan Peterson talked about that drew people to him initially before he went crazy, was talking about the maps of meaning and mythology and all that. And I think that sort of stuff, rooting yourself in the ancient, in your community, your folk, your traditions, you know, like Christmas, like Yule, is a lovely thing. And even beyond that, it is a necessary thing, because you will die if you're uprooted and atomized.
Well, absolutely. Sorry, I was looking for another meme that would have fitted with it, because I've got it in my mind, but I can't find it. So
I know that feeling.
Maybe I didn't save it. But yeah, I think this is a time of transition, and it's happening in different ways in different countries. And I think we're only starting to see I think it's going to get a lot more dramatic than this. For example, the AfD in Germany, I think when they take power, that's going to be another huge acceleration for all of this. Trump, if Vance gets in, or if he doesn't get in, I mean, if the Democrats win, there's going to be huge upheaval then. But I think that even then, they would be fighting against something that I think is unstoppable now. And I wrote this in my two essays late this year about the situation in America and Britain. I think that there are forces that have somehow been unleashed that you're not going to be able to arrest them. If you wanted to, you wouldn't be able to. So, I mean, basically, it's, you could say it's the last 20 years being escaped from, but I think it's also the last 80-100 years being escaped from.
And I do think it is inevitable, and that's why I think it's important to have more measured conversations, because there is, you know, forces are being unleashed here, primal forces that have been pent up. And it is important to have mature, level heads talking about it, people who can say no to the cranks, people who can say no to real hatred. Because, you know, you've been in this sort of world 10 plus years, and you've seen it where, you know, there are genuinely psychotic, hateful, crazy people out there who might be, you know, nominally on our side, whatever that means.
The word I always use is misfits. There are people who
misfits.
They're correct. They're correct about the world, but so what? They're a liability to everyone else.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Sorry.
I've known a number in my own life, and the goal now is to keep it good, keep it righteous. You cannot let yourself be overcome by genuine hatred. You know that. The powers that be like to ban around the word hate, but you know, you don't want to become your enemies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You don't want to become a gift to your enemy. It's the people who you could believe that they actually just hate life itself. They just hate being alive and just negative, damaging people. I think that's the type.
Well, hey, well, we can root them out now. We can tell them by how they look, now that we know about physiognomy.
yeah, indeed. Okay, well, I didn't ask. Is there anything else you'd want to say about that before we finish? Because I think that it is just to sum it up and summarize it. Because I think that is a very interesting thing that more people should probably look into.
I'd say, you know, obviously, most of my stuff is on my YouTube. I would say, though, to sort of go off that general theme and something to end on is I would want to put an open invitation out there for, you know, people, because this is, you know, you're banned from YouTube. Unfortunately, it's a much worse platform for your absence. You know, you have this nice cozy little stream, and it's doesn't have the huge biggest viewership, but it seems like it's like high quality. Like it's a lot of really respected people. That's why, you know, I talk about Dave Green. I explained it to my wife. She was like, "Who's that?" I was like, "He's not like the biggest figure, but among people I watch, he's very well respected." I'd say the same of you probably. And you know, because of that, I think that you probably have a lot of creative and thoughtful people on here. I second guess myself out of doing anything big with Prosopa, with physiognomy for a long time. Cause like, that's crazy talk. The world is crazy now. The old economy is gone. Everyone I know who's successful is a self-made online entrepreneur, basically. You know, this not the 50s anymore where you go to work for the big company. That's all gone. And we're in this age of chaos, which is dangerous, which is a little scary. But it can be a wonderful opportunity if you want to do your own thing. And so I'd love to have more people watching my stuff or anything. But what I really want to see is I want to see more people making their own stuff. I want to see more people getting out there. And, you know, I saw just the other day, a young lady, she started her own YouTube channel talking about physiognomy. She was even using like my little illustrations that I have in my videos and stuff, which I was very honored by. And I was encouraged. And I told her, I said, great, keep doing this. I want to see more people talking about this. Or even with Ubersoy, you know, he made this Substack article and then this video talking about my stuff and calling it like a bunch of bullshit and very kind of polemical. And I did a response to him and we actually discussed it in private. And a lot of my fans were very hostile towards him. They're like, oh, screw him. I loved it because we're on the same, he and I are on the same side. You know, I respect him intellectually and he, you know, was not smearing me or anything. He was saying, I don't believe what this guy does for these reasons. I was able to respond to that. And we had a conversation and I love that. And I want more people to be coming out there and just talking about anything.
See, if you can have a disagreement, if you don't make it personal, if you don't attack the person, then things can happen. Progress can happen. But if you make it, as soon as you make it personal, the other person's going to get defensive, they're going to get insulted, and they're going to save face, and then they'll attack you back, and then spiral.
Yeah.
So it sounds nice that it was a civilized disagreement.
Yeah. And I enjoy that. I mean, that I love the video I made in response to him. I think it was great. I was able to address a lot of the common points that people bring up in the comments of like, what about this? Why is this way? And I was better for it. So I love that dynamic back and forth. And that would be my main message is obviously, you know, I can say the whole thing. Physiognomy is real. You can judge a book by its cover. That's all important and real. But I do that every day on my YouTube channel and on other platforms I work on. But the real big picture message, because this is kind of a big picture show, you know, it's about politics and the world and all that. My message for that would be I'm just a guy with a computer like everyone else watching this. And, you know, all that happened with me was I had a passion about something. I dug into it myself. You know, you can, as the tech guys like to say, I have tech bro friends and they love the, you know, you can just do things line, but it's true. It's corny, but it's true. You can in fact just do things. You don't have to, you know, go to university anymore to get knowledge. The entirety of human knowledge is at your fingertips. Go to the Internet Archive, download some PDFs. You can learn any skill right now. You have to utilize that. There's no more excuse for ignorance. There's no more excuse for not having like a thing that you do. Turn off the Netflix, turn off the porn, put down the blunt, and get good at something and put yourself out there and do something crazy, because that makes the world a more interesting and enjoyable place. If like you have the eccentrics and the oddballs out there who are putting themselves out there and saying, hey, here's what I'm about. And I want more of that. I want to see more of that from the good people out there. So if I can encourage one guy to like start a YouTube channel or a Substack from this appearance, I'll have succeeded. So.
All right. Excellent. Well, this has been great fun. I've enjoyed it. And we've talked about a whole range of different things, more than I was expecting to, actually. Okay. Well, I will be back in 20 minutes with the distributist. But in the meantime, Taylor, you didn't link me to your TikTok, so that's not in the description. But people, I'm sure, can find Prosopa Insights on TikTok if
that's where they are. Yeah, it's the same on every platform.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, great. Taylor, head physiognomist at Prosopa Insights, thank you very much for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Thank you.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Get the info you need at millennial.com/crypto. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.